Anne Blanding today, speaking with Dr. Christine Folch for People Science, and she's a cultural anthropologist at Duke University, and we're going to be talking about her research and these interesting times we're living in. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Erin. I'm really excited to be part of this conversation.
Awesome. So I was wondering to get started if you could tell me about your research and your field and, you know, what impact you hope it has on your field.
Yeah, great. Well, okay, so I'm a cultural anthropologist, which means I study how people live their lives and how they make decisions. But that's like a really broad description of what the discipline is, so I want to focus my comments a little bit more. I work on energy, natural resources, and food in Latin America, mostly Latin America. And so I got into what I research because I've always been interested in issues of social justice and poverty alleviation and underdevelopment. And I've always cared about Latin America, in part because my family is from there. My mother is from Cuba and my father is from the Dominican Republic. So most of my family is immigrants and quite connected to the Caribbean. And I knew that I wanted my life to be about working on issues of social justice and poverty alleviation and meaningful, sustainable economic development in Latin America. But the thing about these issues is that if the solution to these questions were easy or obvious, they would have been solved already. So I went to grad school to study how politics, economics, and justice all come together in Latin America. That was the road in. This is a podcast that's about people's science. And so I want to highlight that my way into the science was not through thinking about the science first, but instead thinking about social issues that captured my imagination. And so to be a little bit more specific about what I work on, so my first book is about renewable energy in Latin America. Latin America is well known in the U.S. for being oil or natural gas exporters, but actually inside of Latin America, people predominantly rely upon renewable energy for electricity. And so I got really interested in how energy extraction and energy production for the continent itself works. And so my first book is about that. My next book, which I'm working on right now, is about yerba mate. Yerba mate is a caffeinated beverage that's really popular in Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, southern Brazil, and all over the Middle East. So it's an agricultural commodity crop. And so you can see that my interests have to do with something about politics, economics in a very particular place and how that intersects with nature. And I think the last part of your question is what impact do I hope my research has on the field? Well, I think what I would say is that I am really lucky. I've gotten to turn my interests into my job. And so I think the thing I would really hope is to open up conversations about how politics and economics works and how that intersects with the kinds of things I'm studying, like energy or natural resources or food. I think that that's a fun conversation to have.
Awesome. That sounds really interesting. I've never really thought about that. So it's really cool to hear you talk about it. And so I'm wondering, you know, we're living in some very interesting times. And I'm wondering what impact have COVID-19 and possibly the Black Lives Matter movement had on your research?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that's important about COVID-19 is that, so COVID-19 in some ways is like super new. In fact, that's the problem, right? What do they say? We're immunologically naive to it because we've never gotten it. And so it sort of goes over the planet, and it has, even if it has a relatively low case fatality rate, when you have a case fatality rate over the entire world population at the same time, that can have a real toll. But in Paraguay, where I predominantly work, and in South America more general, what the pandemic has done is it has revealed underlying inequality.
Rather than, so part of what it does is it doesn't reveal something new. It reveals what's there already. And the thing to know is that Latin America is not poor. It's not poor. It's the most unequal part of the world, but it's not the poorest part of the world. And the country that I predominantly work in, Paraguay, may be actually the most unequal country in Latin America. I'm working with a research team of really brilliant undergraduates who are working on creative ideas for how Paraguay can build equitable, sustainable development options to help it transition out of the COVID-19 crisis. So that's where I see the pandemic having an impact on my research. Now, in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, I think one of the things that's been really interesting to me is to see how Black Lives Matter has captured the imagination of people across the planet. So on July 4th in Paraguay, so Paraguay is a landlocked country in the middle of South America. It's a country that has no tourist traps because it's off the beaten path for so many people. But so, you know, we're not really sure who did it, but some people on July 4th in Paraguay renamed the streets in downtown Asunción. They renamed the streets that were named after the United States or, you know, states in the U.S. They renamed them the names of people like Angela Davis or Black Lives Matter Street. They put up like either graffiti or they changed the street signs to emphasize, I think maybe Frederick Douglass was one of them. I mean, so it has captured the imagination of people across the world.
That's really cool. That is really amazing to hear how, you know, what's happening here in the U.S. impacting people all over. What excites you most about the uprising happening today?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is a national reckoning with racism and power on many different fronts. And the conversation that we're having includes multiple communities and therefore multiple perspectives. So I'm not sure when this podcast is going to be broadcast, but today, Monday, July 13th, the Washington football team announced that it would retire its racist name and logo. And this is a really important victory for Native activists who've pushed for this for decades. Native and First Nation activists have put environment at the center in North America with movements to defend land. So, you know, Oak Flat in Arizona is sacred land to the San Carlos Apache. And there's been a pretty strong movement to try to defend Oak Flat from copper mining. Standing Rock in North Dakota is pretty well known because it captured the imagination of Indigenous and Native and First Nation people across the planet. And the Dakota Access Pipeline, which the Standing Rock movement has opposed, was just ordered like last week or the week before, was just ordered to shut down by a court because the court judged that there were inadequate environmental measures taken in analyzing the pathway of the pipeline. So that is totally connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, but it's not the same. And I think that that's what's super motivating, that this is not just one movement, it's multiple movements. So Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter has pushed us to relearn history and to ask the question today, do Black Lives Matter? And if the answer is yes, then it's time to dismantle structures and laws and practices that say that Black bodies and Black lives matter less than white lives and white bodies, or Latinx lives and Latinx bodies. Now, okay, so next to this is like what's happened with COVID-19, right? COVID-19 has resulted in an uptick in violence and racist acts against Asian Americans. And as a Latina, right, I am particularly aware of how immigrants are
both the backbone of our food systems in this country, and yet how vilified they are in current discourse that blames them for, or blames us for social ills. And so I think there's this really interesting sense that these issues are connected to one another, and that we learn that it's not just one group, that there's a deeper reckoning in the United States around these issues. And I think that that is really motivating, and it's very heartening. I also really love that young people are leading these movements. And so I'm a professor in part because I love research, but in part because I really believe in the power of young people to change the world. And I know that sounds dorky and cheesy, but it's true. And so we see that in these movements. Now, what would I say to the young people who are in, you know, are leading this effervescence? It's the importance of learning history. Of learning things, not just like from like what people were doing in the 1960s, but to learn what people were doing in the 1830s and 1840s, to get connected to the set, to realize that these movements are actually deep and old. This is not something that has just been born from George Floyd's tragic death or Trayvon Martin's tragic death. These are things that are deep and that are old. And so the more that we get connected to that, the more I think rooted these movements also become. But I think it's really exciting.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, as a professor working with undergrads, what do you think is the first step in making your field more welcoming to people of color?
I mean, I think that this field actually, my field, so cultural anthropology actually, I think, is as a subject matter, the field is actually, I think, very attractive to people of color, because we in this discipline don't predominantly focus on the histories and the cultural activities and the politics of a certain population in the North Atlantic world. This discipline, by definition, is interested in people all over the world. So I think that and it is interested in diversity and complexity, even here in North America. So I think the field is actually very attractive to students of color. And I think we have more students of color in our discipline in terms of proportion than probably most other disciplines and majors do. I think that part of the question is maybe a question less about like how do we make cultural anthropology welcoming, but more like how do we help students of color navigate the university in general? I think that would be my answer to that question.
Gotcha. Along the same vein, what advice could you give a young person of color, you know, navigating the university and in cultural anthropology?
Yeah, so I think that my answer is not just going to be just for cultural anthropology, but it's for, so I'm imagining that I'm speaking to like a junior who has an idea for a thesis, or somebody who is like, you know, going into a master's program, or somebody who's in a PhD program and is thinking about how to do that well. I think one of the things I would say is that it's okay to study those issues which are a priority to communities of color. You don't have to, but if you want to, it's totally fine. I sometimes hear students of color criticized for studying their own communities as if it's somehow less intellectually rigorous to be like a Latina who studies diabetes in East LA, or to be somebody who's studying the history of farm workers in Peru. And nobody in graduate school ever advises a white guy to not study German intellectual history because he's white. And that would just be too obvious for him to study white people. Nobody would ever say that. And I think it's absolutely intellectually justifiable for somebody who's Black and a biologist to decide that they want to study the botany of, you know, Black family gardens in the Great Migration, right? Like, I don't know what biologists study. I mean, I think some of them study plants. So, right. And who are interested in strains of like, of how urban gardening happens and how that shapes like landscapes. I don't know. I think that if there are people who are interested in studying that, they have the right to do that. I think the foundational thing is it's fine to study things that you're interested in part because they're connected to the communities that you come from. And when people disparage those kinds of topics, you can just sort of give them a very confused look, because you would never ever tell someone who's white not to study something about Europe because it's obvious and a little overdone. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing, to trust your intellectual interests and curiosities, because that's cool and that's where interesting ideas come from. So that would be the first bit of advice I would have. And the second one would be like kind of what I mentioned earlier, to learn history so that you learn even in the natural sciences, so not just in the social sciences, to learn history to understand who else has been working on these ideas in these areas, because it's probable that we're actually, I mean, you know, you're smart and brilliant and super creative, but there are other smart and brilliant and super creative people as well who've worked on things before you. And to get excited, to get connected to intellectual trajectories, I think it's important to get to be part of that, to know who your intellectual ancestors are and to read them and to learn about them. And then to draw strength from those histories, even as you're navigating your fields or navigating the university in general. And I think maybe the third thing would be to find a community to walk with. So for me, there are I have never been taught by anybody who's in a university context or school context. I've never been taught by anybody who's Dominican. And I had one Cuban professor for one semester when I was in college. So I didn't have like faculty who were from my background that I could lean on, but it has been really important to find other scholars of color and to learn from their experiences, to share my experiences and to workshop ideas and the question of how do you do this with other people of color. That has been super, super important.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Erin Blanding speaking with Dr. Christine Fulch for People Science, and thank you so much for tuning in.